Okay, so with that, we will open up the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for Thursday, April 28th, our last meeting in April. Time flies, doesn't it, committee members?
When you're having fun.
Yes. I thought you'd fill that in. So with that, we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2175A. Beth, if you can fill us in on what this bill does.
Chair, members of the committee, 2175A would permit an officer to issue a written notification to anyone who places, scatters, or stores food, garbage, or other attractants so as to knowingly constitute a lure, attraction, or enticement for a bear, cougar, or wolf. It requires the person receiving the notification to remove the attractant as directed. There is in your packet a -A4 amendment, two parts to the amendment. The first part would add raccoons and coyotes to the list of potentially habituated wildlife, and that was requested by Audubon. The second part would add forestry to the list of activities that the bill does not apply to. Minimal fiscal impact, no statement was issued, and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. Welcome, Representative. And
thank you.
Thank you for bringing us this bill.
Thank you for having us. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast, and that is exactly where we had a problem with feeding bears. And so this bill came to me at the request of the Lincoln County District Attorney, and we found a way to deal with the prosecution of an individual in our county who had habituated bears, many bears. If you don't have the pictures in front of you, you will, I'm sure, before the day is over. And when asked to stop, she declined. And then she went on vacation. And that was not a good thing, because the 20 or so bears that she was feeding seemed to feel that lunch was still should be served, so they went visiting the neighbors to find it. And it's a little bit amusing as we talk about it now, but it was actually a very serious situation. And that's when our district attorney took a look at statutes and felt that perhaps we should have a less cumbersome statute to deal with this issue. So I am going to turn this over to Elijah Michalowski. I hope I got that close, Elijah, who is with our district attorney's office to explain it in more detail. The one thing I would like to mention is the amendments before you. I was not familiar with them, and so we were just having kind of a quick conversation. I will tell you that I don't have any problem with the second part of it, and I don't think Elijah does either. The first piece of it, in terms of which creatures should be covered by this, the bill originally read bear, cougar, deer, elk, feral swine, raccoon, and wild turkey. And those were removed in an amendment on the House side so that it just now reads bear, cougar, and wolf. Oh, I'm sorry, coyote. I missed coyote in there. And part of the reasoning was after some significant discussion in the committee on the House side, there was a lot of concern over inclusion of deer, elk, and wild turkey. Some people feed deer and elk and to encourage them to be around. Wild turkeys seem to go wherever they want to, and that's why it was narrowed. Had a little bit of concern on the House side if someone had garbage out and wasn't intentionally drawing creatures in, but that's why it was narrowed. So I'll leave that to you. I don't know whether we'd get full concurrence if we extended at this point, but that is a conversation that began on the other side.
So thank you.
With that, I'll turn it over here.
Madam Chair, before we hear testimony, could we get clarification where the A4s are coming from?
Yes, and also I was going to call up the Department of Fish and Wildlife as well to talk about that, but
just yes. A point of reference,
yep.
So when we know.
Go ahead, Beth.
Yeah, the addition of the animals was an Audubon request, and the addition of the forestry provision was OFIC.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Elijah Michalowski. I am a deputy district attorney in Lincoln County, and I had the I guess I'll call it the pleasure of prosecuting the infamous Bear case. So for those of you who aren't familiar with this case, what it was is we had a woman in South Lincoln County in the Yahats area who began feeding bears on her property. And it started it innocently enough. There was a bear that she felt was exhibiting some signs of being sick. She bought some antibiotics, put them in a food ball, and left them out for the bear. That, over a series of years, turned into as many as 25 bears frequenting her property. She told law enforcement that she spent about $100,000 of her own money feeding these bears. There should be some pictures that I gave to the committee assistant. There's a packet as well that's got several pictures. That the top two pictures you can see, they're actually meant to go together, and you can see 14 bears in her yard at one time, each on their own pile of food. Now, the issue, there were some problems with bears in the neighborhood that sort of started to crop up after this began, but as several years went by, in 2008, finally, she went on vacation for about 3 weeks in June, and anybody who knows bears know that June is a time when bears are really feeding a lot. And what happened was when she left, the bears became a huge problem for her neighbors. And this, in turn, became a problem for the bears because what you had was in that three-week period where she was gone, the bears were seeking food from her neighbors instead of from her, and four of those bears had to be put down as nuisance bears. At least four. We know four were reported. We don't know if there were any more or beyond that. But so in that period, what we had is we had a bear that destroyed some poultry coops and ate about 60 heritage turkeys that one of the neighbors was raising to sell. We had another bear here smash through the window in the middle of the night, kitchen window of an 80-year-old couple, Happ and Betty Ayers. We had another bear come through the doggy door of another neighbor and get his head stuck in the doggy door and then actually rip out the entire doggy door as he backed out. Had a problem where a bear went into a barn where horse feed was kept and tore the door off its hinges to a locked room where the feed was. All these happened in a short amount of time, and it all happened because these bears were looking for this food source that instantly dried up. And what we had during the trial is we had quite a bit of testimony of how that by habituating the bears, what was created was a problem not only for the neighbors. I mean, obviously there are safety concerns and for the neighbors and for their property as well. But it was a problem for these bears, and there was quite a bit of lengthy testimony from biologists of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife who talked about how the process of habituating bears goes, and how these bears were conditioned and to look for the types of food that she had been feeding them. And one of the pictures you can see a young bear eating from a cat food bag. And what we saw in the incidents is we saw bears actually walk by go right past berry bushes, right past apple trees, these things that you normally would expect them to eat, and go to where the human-sourced food was, go towards food that was in bags and those kinds of things. And so we, after getting multiple complaints, it was addressed with her, and she refused to stop. And so we decided that we were going to prosecute, and we started looking at the statutes. And what we found was that current Oregon law is a pretty clunky fit for this kind of situation. And we ended up prosecuting her under two statutes, recklessly endangering another. I should point out at this point that the jury actually acquitted her on all of those counts. But we also prosecuted her under harassing wildlife. That has actually spawned a lengthy appeal. Court of Appeals actually heard it on Tuesday, whether this kind of action fits under that statute. I'm confident that the Court of Appeals is going to uphold the conviction, until they actually rule, we will see. And so what the new bill does, or what the new law would do, is it gives this ODF&W and law enforcement a mechanism to issue a warning. And so we wanted to start there. We didn't want to be hard-handed about it. And it issues a warning. It says, is this kind of behavior won't be tolerated, that it causes problems and you need to stop doing it. And only then, if that warning is issued and that warning is ignored, would a prosecution and be able to go forth under this new law. I think that pretty much covers sort of the basics, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. I do have some, but we'll see if some committee members have questions. And then I would like to call up ODFMW, and you're welcome to stay for that because they may be able to answer that. And then we have some school children that would like to testify on this bill. So if you wanted to be able to stay for that, I think that would be helpful.
Yes.
Do you have any questions, Senator
yeah.
Haas? Go first. Yeah.
Just to comment, Madam Chair, my other job, we preach the importance of visuals in making a presentation, and these visuals up here kind of had me at hello, and just really compelling.
It reminded me of the movie with the grizzly man, but anyway.
Grizzly man.
Those bear movies don't always have happy endings.
Yes, I did know that. Senator Olson, you had a question, and then we'll go down here.
Representative Cowan, thank you very much for testifying. Are you comfortable with the amendment with the bear, cougar, wolf, coyote, and raccoon? Are you comfortable with that addition to this bill, or
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. I don't personally have any problem with the inclusion of any of those. It may stem a little more concern back on the House side. I think the raccoon one may concern folks because people leave out dog food and then inadvertently attract raccoons, which happens in my neighborhood all the time. I would very much like that to be something that stops, but I am concerned because the primary objection that I heard voiced was that someone would be in trouble for doing something they had unintentionally left out, and so I'm not sure how those would go.
One follow.
Would you mind if we included skunks?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I didn't know that people were in the practice of feeding skunks, but I don't think encouraging them to your back door is a good idea.
That's right. Thank you for your testimony.
I was going to say, I don't think I would agree to skunks, but I think we're going to hear from Audubon, too, about why they wanted to include the Senator Thompson.
Oh, thank you, Chair Dingfeld. My question was kind of the same as Alan's. I know that in my neighborhood, too, if you you feed cats and dogs, once in a while a raccoon comes up. So how would you deal with that? If everybody that gets a raccoon show up on their back door, are you going to issue one of these warnings? Because how can you discriminate if it's in the bill?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, Senator Thompson, members of the committee. That's what we do every day as prosecutors, is we take the facts and we get all of the information, and quite often a case comes across my desk and it's a fit. It fits a statute. I could prosecute under that statute, but it's not appropriate for whatever reason. It maybe seems a little heavy-handed. So I guess my first answer would be, we exercise prosecutorial discretion. We would, of course, exercise that in this case. My second answer is a little more long-winded and lawyerly, I guess, which is that I think that when considering this bill, there's two real policy objectives that you need to kind of consider. And one is the protection of human life and, just from physical injury. And property, and the other is the protection of the animals. And so when you look at the list of animals that you want to include, I think what you have to do is you have to weigh these two policies and is it your vote for this bill a vote that says, I want to protect humans and I want to protect humans from animals that could be habituated, or is it, I want to protect animals that habituation is a problem to the survival of that species, or it's a problem to local survival. And so it's a difficult question to answer. Would we prosecute a specific raccoon case? Probably not. Most, you know, somebody who's just leaving a little food out for a local cat. But having the tool there for somebody who's attracting a large number of raccoons that's really becoming a nuisance to their neighborhood, it would be a valuable tool.
Well, in the way that I read this bill, and since you have two members of the Judiciary Committee here,
right,
knowingly constitute a lure, attraction, or enticement. So if you are leaving out cat food for your cat and a raccoon is eating it, that's not, in the way I read this, knowingly luring a raccoon. So that knowingly, I would imagine, is something you'd be looking at.
And Senator Dingfield and members of the committee, I think you've hit on something very important about the bill, and that it is that it's knowingly, and that's also where the idea of the warning comes in place, because it is, as we talked about putting forth a bill, one of the concerns was, you know, a lot of people don't realize the impact at what they're doing. You know, they see an animal, they think it's cute or fuzzy, or they think it's sick and they think it's starving and they want to feed it and help it out. And the biologists tell us that, you know, in a lot of cases that's actually harmful to that animal, and they're actually retraining that animal away from its natural food sources. And so, you know, we approach it from this idea that we don't want to be heavy-handed with it. We don't want people who really don't know that they're having this impact fall under this. You know, in the noise case specifically, she had been warned by both neighbors and state officials, and so, you know, we felt like that was fair game. And so the knowing, you know, that's kind of, there's two protections there. One is the knowing element, and we'd have to prove that the person did know that they were attracting these animals. And two, there's that first step of warning them first and then having them ignore the warning and continue to do the behavior.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Legal question. Why didn't you just use the term wildlife instead of specifying bears, cougars,
I think
wolf?
We'll have ODF&W who can come up and talk about that, actually.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Look for me. Answer.
Yeah. Do you want to, are you addressing that? Yeah.
No, I'm not addressing
okay.
it.
We'll have ODF&W can start walking up to the to the podium so you can...
Elijah, can you walk me through this? I've read through this twice. I see what this basically provides for giving notice to someone who's actually engaged in this knowingly. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
What happens next is an application of another statute that's currently on the books, and that, you're going to test my memory, but I believe it's 498-002. And what that statute does is it's sort of the catch-all in the game and wildlife provisions, and what that's, and under that statute, that a violation of the wildlife code can be prosecuted as a misdemeanor.
And what's the offense?
It's from memory, it's a Class A offense.
And what was the reference again?
I believe it is 498-002.
Okay, so I think I'll have the department come up and try to answer some of the questions, and maybe if you can stick around in case there's some
close.
Other questions. Thank you. Gentlemen? And then we'll take public testimony after that. Welcome.
Thanks, Chair Dingfelder. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we did actually bring some written testimony as well on this bill. So I'm going to leave you with the written testimony. I'm just going to highlight the fact that our staff does deal with many, many cases like this, if you will, across the state. Typically speaking, when we have wildlife issues, damage issues associated with typically in urban areas, more times than not, there is someone in the neighborhood that is feeding these animals and causing the attractive nuisance. And I have with me Ron Anglin here, Wildlife Division Administrator. I'd like to have Ron go ahead and answer you had some specific questions that you wanted answered, so I'm going to go ahead and have Ron do that.
Senator?
Question. Why didn't you just include all wildlife?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Senator Olson, when you include all wildlife, it gets into wild birds. We have a lot of wild bird feeding. We're not you can have problems, but it's usually something we can deal with in helping people. It's not causing damage type problems. It's more of a health problem for the birds. So the discussions, and we were involved in working with the county on the original language, and the discussions were to focus in on kind of the big species that seem to cause the most problems and that we find ourselves dealing with, either from a damage standpoint or animals that are dying due to sickness.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator?
Yes, thank you. We heard from the assistant district attorney that the default would go to 498.002. Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, I'm looking at it. It says wildlife as a state property, and it basically sets forth what you can't do. And I look at this, and I don't see where you're going to be able to do anything, because when I read this, it says wildlife is property of the state. No person shall angle for, take, hunt, trap, or possess, or assist another person, blah, blah, blah. So if they're just putting food out, are we going to make the leap that they're now possessing it because they're feeding it? Because if the animal's free to leave and goes as it wants, I don't know if we're going to get to possessing as compared to being caged, fenced, or others. And then the other part, I guess, is this, is when I look at what the penalties are, which are found under 498.993, unless I'm wrong on going to the penalties, 498.002 doesn't seem to be captured in that area. Now, maybe there's another set of penalties I missed, but what I see in that area of penalties are just Class A violations. So y'all can help me out understand, because, I mean, it sounds like we're setting up paperwork to give someone notice, but you're really not going to be able to do anything outside of giving them this notice.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Przanski, we haven't had a chance to talk with the district attorney about 498.002. You're right on the possession part of it. If the animals are free to come and go, we would not classify that as possession. We've had those discussions with people in the past under similar type circumstances, and no citations have been issued. And I think that's part of what the problem has been in the past, whether it's feeding bears, whether it's feeding raccoons. The question came up on that earlier, that the inadvertent, you know, raccoon gets into the pet food on the back porch. That's different than somebody that has 30 to 50 raccoons that they're feeding, and that those animals are, you know, going out and causing problems at the neighbors. Eventually, we find out about it either because there's problems or we have a huge distemper outbreak and you have a bunch of sick raccoons that all of a sudden are dying all over in the neighborhood. And, you know, the common way to have dealt with that in the past has been, well, you go trap those raccoons and you just move them. That's not a real effective solution to the problem. It's not the raccoon's fault that they found an easy food supply, but we've had no clean way that we could get the people to stop. The actual penalties section that you're looking for, I'd have to do look real quick, but they're found in 496 and 497 is where it really gets into the penalty section, and are the pieces that we would draw from. 496.705 is where it, well, the 496.680 is where it starts getting into some of the penalties associated with wildlife crimes. Then there's a little bit in 497 that gets into it also. But the 496.680 through about 715 gets into the major portions of where we would deal with the penalties portion of it and what state police would look to cite under.
Okay. So we'll take a look at those and follow up, because we want to make sure that there's not a gap here.
I'd just like to put this on the record. I understand where I see the penalty section, but if we're talking about enforcing something in this section of 498 based on penalties in 496, normally we don't relate to penalties in a different chapter for a chapter on offense or, let's say, a violation of a conduct. So I think we need to have a little bit more information before we know, make sure we're doing something that's actually going to do what we intend to do. Understanding there's a problem here, but we want to make certain that you actually have the tools in the toolbox.
And the question I would have is, would we need to reference that in in this law as far as what part of the penalty statutes we'd want to send people to? Because I'm not hearing that there's clear direction.
or if someone is in. My understanding at this point, if someone, let's say, continues to violate it after they've been noticed, it seems like there should be something in the statute that says upon this occurring, then you refer to whatever else you're going to have for enforcement.
Okay, well, we'll make sure and follow up. Other questions that we have for the department? Because I wanted to ask about the inclusion of cougars or coyotes and raccoons. We already have bear, cougar, and wolf. Do you have any comments on the amendment that includes coyotes and raccoons?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, again, Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We certainly see significant issues in numerous areas of the state associated with people intentionally feeding raccoons, coyotes, and other species that were alluded to in some of the earlier testimony. So with regard to inserting those two species, we do believe that broadens our or broadens the effects on our abilities to address some of those problems.
And Chair Dingfelder, I think that to answer some of your specific questions on the citations and where they would fall, Oregon State Police would be the ones that could best answer those. And if you'd like, it might be appropriate to ask them to come and either meet with the committee, whether you want one-on-one or back in front of the full committee. They'd be able to tell you how they would typically do that and give you the specific citations that they would use.
And we will follow up with them and make sure we get back to committee members. Senator Thompson.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder. On the House side, this was all, they had their hearings and discussed these issues. And were coyotes and raccoons on the original bill? And did you say the same thing to the House side that you said here today?
So, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, yeah, there are raccoons, coyotes, deer, elk, wild turkeys were also included, and I'm not sure if there was any other species or not. Feral swine, feral pigs were also included. Those were removed. I think the discussion was largely around addressing animals that could pose a risk to humans in terms of a direct physical threat, and that's kind of where the committee went.
So they hashed it all out, and this is what they came up with. So okay.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, that's correct. They basically just left in the large predators.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for the department? All right. Thank you. I'm sure we'll be following up. So we have some folks that would like to testify on this. As you can see, we've had quite a bit of discussion, and I have. How about if you all come up together and make sure I'm saying this right? Is it Shunpai, Jessica, and Chloe? Hi there. Thanks for coming today.
Hi.
Taking off of school. I heard your whole class is here. Is that correct?
Only three of us.
Okay.
After school.
So can you say your name and where you're from, and then you need to make sure and talk into the microphone so we can all hear you, and there's also people.
You know, just turn the microphone towards you. You don't have to lean into it. It's very sensitive.
There's people watching on the web as well. So
right, camera, candy camera.
Right. I'm Chloe Amelchuk, and we're from Willowhurst School, K through 8.
Which is in my district, by the way.
I'm Jessica Sims.
And I'm Shinpei Mori Gillis.
Great. Well, welcome. So who would like to go first?
Me. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. We're representing Lower School K-8 Project Citizen class. Project Citizen is a program through Classroom Project that focuses on children addressing current issues in their community and creating public policies to solve the problem. In our group, we are focusing on the problem of urban coyotes, more specifically a no-feed ordinance.
Through the course of our research about this problem, we've examined many different solutions, such as relocation, and killing the coyotes, but we have rejected these ideas because they cause more problems than they solve. And we have learned that people have been feeding these coyotes intentionally up to 50 pounds of food a day, And we believe that the problem is not that the coyotes are coming in and living in the city, it's that they're becoming habitualized. And when a coyote becomes habitualized, they lose their instinctual fear of humans that makes them feel the need to run away. And this brings out more aggressive qualities and it makes them more unfriendly, if that makes sense. But this problem is so bad that in some counties such as Alameda, people have been spotting them out in broad daylight, and as well as walking down the middle of the streets and even stalking owners and their pets when they're walking out on the street. And I'm sure Bob Salinger will tell you more about this. But I have a testimony here.
Great. Just hand that to Erica. And Pi, would you like to say something?
So coyotes, to conclude, coyotes are just as much of a problem as cougars, wolves, and bears, if not more. Because people didn't realize the danger of these animals. A habitualized coyote has the potential to be just as dangerous as a wolf, bear, or cougar, because they are more likely to become habitualized having more contact with humans on a day-to-day basis. We believe that adding coyotes into this bill, 2175, would be a good solution to this problem, as well as benefit our urban society. We support this bill and the amendment of the Audubon Society has proposed.
So is this really a picture of a coyote on Max?
Yes, he was found on the Max train.
Do you think he paid his fare?
Probably not.
Representative Dembro, who is, if you live in Northeast Portland, is your state representative, told me he saw a coyote walking through his neighborhood the other morning when he was walking his dog. So, yes, I do know that they live in our district and are certainly a problem when they get fed and like to hang out. So really appreciate you all coming here today to testify. Let's see if there's any questions from any of my committee members. No? Great. Well, thank you for your testimony. Really appreciate it. And I know that the representative that sponsored the bill appreciates you coming here today to share your thoughts about why this bill should include coyotes. So thank you so much. I hope you'll stay because we've got some other folks that are going to testify.
Yes.
We have Bob Salinger from Audubon. Very effective, Bob, to have children
bring
come.
Bring the kids.
I think he's going to bring him for all his testimony now. And Mike from OFIC. Did you take this picture of the coyote on Max?
I didn't. That was actually taken by the Port of Portland.
Wow.
Yeah, he was removed from the train and released into the wilds of PDX. And for the record, they actually came on their own today. I spoke to them a while back, but they emailed me last night or 2 days ago and said they were coming down. They've been working on this on their own, so this is a class project that they're doing. Good afternoon, Chair Dinkfelder and members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the conservation director for the city for Audubon Society of Portland, and I'm here today to support House Bill 2175, as well as the amendments that would include coyotes and raccoons. You've already heard about the other species, so I'll focus in on coyotes and raccoons. We work very closely with ODF&W, U.S. Department of Agriculture, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, a variety of different organizations that deal with wildlife in the city, and we receive about 15,000 phone calls a year at our Urban Wildlife Resource Center dealing with urban wildlife. And a significant number of those are conflict situations, situations where animals are in attics, animals have bitten people, you know, a variety of different types of things. The most difficult situations we deal with and and the most common are involve raccoons and coyotes. And we get those calls all the time. I would estimate that we're going to take, we took in at least 500 phone calls involving those species last year. And more often than not, when we're getting those phone calls, the problem has been precipitated by people deliberately feeding these animals. And this bill is not designed to go after the folks who are putting out dog food and cat food in the evening to feed their cats. And what we're talking about here are situations where people are actually going out and purposely putting out food for these animals. We get calls from people that say that they're putting out 40 and 50 pounds of dog food at night, and they're looking for grants to be able to continue to do it. In the situation in Alameda, we actually had people driving through the neighborhood in cars and putting food out the window into places where they knew the coyotes would be. We apparently had a situation where somebody was putting out dead chickens for them. And these situations are all too common. This isn't about protecting the wildlife, although we're a wildlife protection agency. This is a situation where we're trying to protect the public property as well as people. And these animals, when they become habituated, are a real threat. Under normal circumstances, they're not. But when they become habituated, they lose their fear of humans. It also leads to unnaturally large congregations of these animals that the environment can't support. With raccoons, we get call, it's a fairly frequent call where somebody says, I was feeding two, and then they brought some of their friends, and I was feeding five, and now I'm feeding 50. You would never have 50 raccoons in a geographic area but for the fact that people are putting out massive amounts of food for them, and the environment can't sustain that. And finally, it also leads to disease vectors where when you have animals coming to the same spot over and over again and one's sick, suddenly they're all sick, and so we get outbreaks of distemper and parvo and things like that at unnaturally high levels as well. And so when you have those kinds of events happening, what you have is animals that start approaching people, that start coming up on decks, that start living in attics, that start looking for handouts, and that's when you have bites occur. And if you look, for example, at the coyote bites that have occurred nationwide, there's probably been about 180 of them total, according to this, the literature. About half of those were predatory in nature, where the coyote was actually deliberately attacking a person, and almost all of those have been linked to feeding. And although they're a relatively small animal, 25 to 35 pounds, you don't want that animal coming after you. We see this as a common sense inclusion. These are the two worst species in terms of habituation on the urban landscape. I could give you a list of about another 10 that I'd love to see in this bill, but for today, I think this would really hit the worst and most problematic species. This is a bill that's good for people and good for wildlife. It'll protect these species because once they do become problems, it's almost impossible to reverse that. They're removed from the environment. Either they're relocated or they're destroyed. Relocation usually winds up in their death as well. And during my time at Audubon since 1992, we've seen the nuisance trapping industry explode in Portland. We've gone from a single licensed nuisance trapper in 1992 to more than 40 today. And those are businesses that just go around and trap wild animals and get them out of neighborhoods because they're problems. Again, bad for the wildlife, bad for the people. So we encourage you to adopt this bill and include the amendments. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob. Mike.
Chair Dingfelter, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I here also appreciate the Audubon Society introduction of the amendments, specifically the last one. Going back to when it came up on the House side, there was a lot of activity going on for the agency as far as bills with cougars, wildlife, wolves, everything going on. I mentioned to them the inclusion of forestry operations. And quite frankly, I think it kind of just fell through the cracks on the House side, introducing the term forestry operations as well. My concern at that point is, again, listed bear species. A number of our members actually use a supplemental feeding program as a means of non-lethal bear damage control as one option, and by not inclusion of forestry operations in there, I believe that takes one of the tools out of our toolbox. So very, very simply, I just support the amendments, especially the inclusion of forestry operations and the exemptions with agricultural and ranching operations.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mike. Any questions for either Bob or Mike? Okay.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Okay.
Sure.
Seeing that, Senator Thompson.
Could Department of Fish and Wildlife come back up for a quick question?
Are they still here?
Still here.
Okay, quickly. Actually, we'll have them stay up because we'll do conservation stamp next. Actually, we're going to have you stay up because we're going to do 2127 next. So we'll be efficient here. Senator Thompson, your question?
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you. Thanks. I heard 15,000 calls, and I heard, I don't know what all those calls were, I heard 500 raccoon calls. Kurt, who's going to be your raccoon response team person, and is that funded?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, actually, We have reduced, in fact, almost totally eliminated all of our response to these types of complaints. Mm-hmm. We used to do that, and over the past decade or more of general fund, state general fund reductions, we have basically really cut back on responding to these complaints. And I think that is in large part why we've seen this expansion of the private industry trappers to literally go out and address these conflicts in urban areas, as you heard Mr. Salinger reference in his testimony.
So where are these calls going to go? Who's going to make these issuances?
Bob, you want to come up?
Yeah,
so, come on up.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah,
I
fine.
Say one thing, and that is...
Bob Salinger, Audubon Society, Portland. The vast majority of these phone calls we can deal with through education, and that's a really important point. Most people are doing this unwittingly. They don't realize they're causing a problem, and if we talk to them, they'll stop. And so this is really a tool in the toolkit. For the vast majority, groups like Audubon, ODF&W, the nuisance trappers can work with the public and resolve the situation without involving any sort of regulatory structure or punitive measures. What this really is for is for the people, and unfortunately there are too many of them, who say, no, I'm going to keep doing it for whatever reason. This gives us, in other jurisdictions that have done this, you know, it's been demonstrated that having that hammer behind you is helpful in some situations. It sends a message that the state doesn't want this to happen, that we all agree that it's a bad thing, and that there is repercussions when people don't respond. But those are pretty rare. I would guess out of the 500-plus phone calls we get on these issues, you know, 95% of the people are responsive when they realize it's the 5% that we need to send a message to.
So if I read this bill, like Senator Przanski said, it sounds like it does just what it says. It permits officer to issue a written notification to any person who places, scatters, stores food garbage. And that's exactly all it's going to do. So will that be enough to create the hammer you're talking about? Because that's all it's going to be able to do.
No, Senator Thompson. I think what we need to be able to do is to actually issue citations. I think there needs to be an ability in rare situations. I hate to see it happen all the time, and I have no expectation that it would, but I think in rare situations where somebody's doing something like what the bear situation or some of these folks that insist on continuing to put out food when their neighbors are all complaining and the animals are being trapped and removed, we do need the ability to actually cite people. It doesn't have to be a large citation, but it needs to be enough to make them feel it.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, I just, as a follow-up, mm-hmm. I don't think this bill's designed to do that.
Do you, anybody want to respond? Yeah, why don't you come up?
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get a lawyer up here.
Yes, and I'll give you a lawyerly answer.
Yeah.
Or Senator Dinkfelder, Senator Thompson. My answer is I'm going to get back to you. I'm going to go back and have a discussion with Rob Bovette, who is also chief proponent of this bill. It was my memory that it was based on the 498-002, but as pointed out by Senator Przanski, I think I was remembering wrong. And so what we will do is I'll get you the legal authority, and we will do some follow-up.
Okay, great.
I think we need to do some follow-up on this, and we'll make sure to work with the chief sponsor of the bill, Representative Cowan. Regarding your comment about calls, I think the reality is the calls are going to happen no matter what, and they already are happening. It's just a matter of how do we try to, if anything, prevent this from happening further and try to reduce the amount of calls that we'll get in the long term, because there are people out there that are doing this, and the question is how do you make sure and have it, as I've heard, another tool in the toolbox to prevent this situation from escalating. And so I think that's what the intent of this bill is. So we looks like we need a little bit of more work. My staff will follow up with you all and also Representative Cowan and District DA. So thank you. With that, we will go ahead and close the public hearing. You guys can stay,
yep.
Or Kurt, you can stay because you're up next. We will close the public hearing on 2175A. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2127. Beth?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2127 would authorize the Department of Fish and Wildlife to create and to contract for the design and production of an annual habitat conservation stamp. allows ODF&W to charge a maximum of $50 for the stamp with a revenue deposit in the Oregon Conservation Strategy subaccount. There is a fiscal statement that's in your packet and no revenue impact.
Okay. Kurt.
Thank you. Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And House Bill 2127, appreciate the opportunity to come to you today and talk to you about House Bill 2127. This is an agency bill that was introduced by Governor Kitzhaber on our behalf. This bill essentially is one of our many attempts to diversify our funding base, in particular for implementation of the Oregon Conservation Strategy. The Conservation Strategy is a non-regulatory, a voluntary approach to habitat conservation actions on private land and public land. We've had great public support for the strategy itself. We have not had great funding support, if you will, over the last several years. So we're looking to diversify our funding base for implementation of that strategy. This is one of our avenues, if you will, that we'd like to try. So we're asking for the authority for the Fish and Wildlife Commission to essentially establish a habitat conservation stamp. It's modeled after our waterfowl and upland bird stamp programs. One key difference in this program is that it is non-compulsory, so it's not associated with any activity. No one will be required to purchase a habitat conservation stamp. It merely provides an opportunity for voluntary investment in our Oregon Conservation Strategy. People right now already, the department can accept donations. We do accept a small number of donations annually, so one might say, why do we need to do this? You guys can already take donations. That is true, but this bill does create a separate sub-account so that when someone donates for this activity, it's going to go into our Conservation Strategy sub-account. And more importantly, we really feel this is going to give us an important marketing angle, if you will. We're going to aggressively work with our both private business as well as other conservation partners to market this stamp as an opportunity for folks to invest in conservation in Oregon, and hopefully be able to turn it into a good program over the long term. We at least want to try. So we're looking for the authority to do that. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have if you have any more specifics about the program or any in general.
Questions?
I have a question. Will these stamps be collectible? Will there be different pictures?
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson. So our waterfowl stamp and our upland bird stamp programs, we issue a different stamp every year. It is truly a stamp. It's got adhesive on the back. It's truly a stamp that people collect. In fact, we sell waterfowl stamps and upland bird stamps to people that never buy hunting licenses. There are people that just collect these stamps for their collectability, the artwork component. And then these programs also always include not just the sale of the relatively small stamp itself, but we also include sale of artwork that is essentially a much larger image or much larger version of the same image.
Okay. Other questions for the department?
No.
Okay, great. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
We've got a few folks that would like to testify on this, so I'll call them up. Bruce Taylor, Al Elkins, and Joe Rowlater. This is an interesting trio. You should take a picture.
For the stamp.
Right.
Kodak moment.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. This is such a good bill and such an easy one. I didn't prepare a statement. Passed the House 58-1. As you heard from the department.
Could you say your name first?
Excuse me. Bruce Taylor, Defenders of Wildlife. What this is about is it's about, in part, diversifying the Department of Fish and Wildlife's funding sources, particularly for the Oregon Conservation Strategy. And this one is not going to make the big difference in funding the Oregon Conservation Strategy. Those of you on the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources have that opportunity through the governor's budget. But I think in terms of raising public awareness and providing a vehicle for people to feel like they play a direct role beyond buying lottery tickets and things like that, it's a great thing for the Oregon Conservation Strategy. And as somebody who just recently bought the Upland Game Bird stamp, a beautiful sage grouse print, which available for sale at the Department of Fish and Wildlife headquarters, the artwork alone is a really nice thing and just a great program for the department and a good bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. We support this bill. We think it's good for critters, good for Oregon's conservation habitat strategy, and we were part of developing that plan. I'd like to see it get a few more bucks in, and this is a good, very good way to go. So we wholeheartedly support this effort. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bill.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I represent the McKenzie River Guides Association. We support this bill. We've also worked with a very diverse group of other folks to figure out various ways to fund the conservation strategy, and this is just one of the many ways that we've talked about over the years, and we think this is a good way to start. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for these gentlemen? Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else like to testify on this bill? House Bill 2127. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2127. We'll open up the work session on House Bill 2127. Beth, do we have all the paperwork we need?
You do.
Okay, so can you just remind us about the fiscal?
There is a fiscal statement in your file. What it talks about is what revenue would be brought in if a certain number of stamps are sold.
Okay. All right, thank you. Well, I will take a motion on this bill.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2127 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2127 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Happ?
Aye.
Senator Happ?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Senator Dingfelder?
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and do we have any volunteers to carry this bill? Okay, Senator Olson, thank you. And so note that Senator Olson will carry the bill to the floor. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2127. And we will go ahead and open up our last public hearing of the day, House Bill 3157. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview, please.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 3157 would extend the Oregon Adopt a River Program to include the removal of certain invasive species, which would be identified in a list created by the State Marine Board. It requires the board to provide volunteer groups with instructions for removal of those species and best management practices regarding disposal and equipment decontamination. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact statement in your packet.
Okay, excellent. And we have some people signed up to testify. We have the Marine Board is here, but I didn't know if they wanted to testify. Are you just here for? Okay. So we have Christy Split. Christy, you want to come up with Rep. Cannon's office? Sarah Ryan and Lisa. Make sure I'm saying your name right. There's Lisa. Yeah, Cooper K. Okay, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Christy Split. I am a legislative aide to Representative Ben Cannon. But today, I am here in a different capacity. 4 years ago, Representative Cannon stole me from Solve, the legendary nonprofit founded by Tom McCall. And I'm here today as a former employee. And the reason I'm here is because Solve has very strict guidelines as a nonprofit regarding their political advocacy. So an employee like Sarah Ryan, who I've brought up with me and who will testify after me, cannot advocate for or against any policy, including House Bill 3157. Beth gave a great overview of the bill. Just by way of explanation of how the how Solve and the Adopt a River program have evolved, Solve, the organization, was founded to stop Oregon litter and vandalism. But as the organization learned more and more about other threats to the natural resource heritage of our state, the mission grew. Today, Solve's work ranges from litter removal to invasive species removal, from service learning, that's what I did when I worked there, to native tree planting. Sometimes, and in the best possible case, they do all these things at once. Adopt a River is a partnership between Solve and the State Marine Board, and it's a program of Solve where there's a Solve staffer that works on the Adopt a River program. That person recruits organizations, businesses, and individuals to adopt a stretch of Oregon River and then keep it clean. You might be familiar with the Adopt a Highway program. It's very similar, and in fact, in 2009, we amended the Adopt a River program in a similar fashion in order to allow, the Adopt a Highway program, the adoptees of Highway to remove invasive species and these invasive weeds. So the program, I I distributed this nice little report from Solve on the program. The program has been very successful, but it's limited in that success because Adopt-A-River funds cannot be used for invasive species removal. I know that Lisa Debrecaire will be up here to talk about why invasive species removal is so important, but I just want to say this. In 2010, 52,000 pounds of litter were removed from 500 miles of Riverside over the course of over 1,800 volunteer hours. What if those same volunteers had been able to remove invasive weeds while they were at it? What if Solve staff had been able to teach them the telltale signs of, say, a white bryonia, and then helped them to properly remove those plants from the riverside? I could benefit from being an Adopt-A-River volunteer and learn a little bit more about invasive weeds. But while Sarah can't say it, I'll say it. This bill would make Adopt-A-River a better program. I hope that you'll move the bill. It passed unanimously from the House floor. It has no fiscal impact. And Sarah's here to talk about kind of the logistics of the program and can answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Sarah, let me go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. My name is Sarah Ryan.
Can you move the mic so we can hear you? Thank you.
Yep. All right. Thanks. For the record, I'm Sarah Ryan, and I'm a program manager at Solve. And I'm just here to give a couple key points about the program itself and answer any questions you may have about how we operate the program. The annual budget for the program is around $44,000. $31,000 comes from the Oregon State Marine Board to cover expenses, and the rest is raised by Solve. The program serves all kinds of volunteers. It serves groups like fishing clubs, companies, rafting groups, as well as individuals who just have a favorite stretch of river that they like to get out and clean up once or twice a year. The program is statewide. The majority of the adoptions are in the valley where most of the people live, but there is a Google map in your packet that shows a distribution of the river adoptions. Let's see here. The structure of the program is that the people doing the adoptions have to adopt at least 2 miles for 2 years and do at least 2 cleanups, and most of the groups do much more. For example, this weekend, Thompson Sanitary is doing an entire Quinna Bay cleanup in Newport that they do twice a year, and they involve the entire community to get involved. And a lot of people just tell us they adopt a section of the river because it helps them to get out, learn more about the river and the habitat, and they love it, and some people have been going there for years with their families. So this would be simple for Solve to implement. The majority, throughout all of our programs, we support 4 main activities, and they are removing litter, like we're known for on the beach cleanup, but also removing invasive plants, planting native plants, and then taking care of those for the long term, for long-term stewardship. So it would just be basically adopting Adopt-A-River to have the same format as the rest of our programming.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any questions?
No.
These ladies? Okay.
I do have a question.
Senator Olson has a question.
We have Adopt-A-River. Can we add a lake to that?
It's pretty much any waterway, so
okay.
Some people do adopt lakes.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. I have spent my share of trying to remove blackberries and Japanese knotweed, so I'm very thrilled to see you move forward. So thank you.
Thank you.
And Lisa, do you want to come up?
So, Madam Chair, while she's coming up, I was wondering if Senator Olson was going to be a foster parent to a particular lake.
You want to adopt your own lake?
Yeah, it would be great, wouldn't it?
We can get him right here on the record to do that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Debrecaire. I'm the Oregon Invasive Species Council Coordinator, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 3157, Oregon's Adopt-A-River Program. As many of you are aware, invasive species pose terrible threats to Oregon's economy, environment, and quality of life. They degrade our rivers, stream habitats, plant communities. They disrupt food chains. They just do a lot of really bad things. And so if we can be efficient and effective in combining other cleanup efforts on rivers with invasive species removal, it's a smart way to go, and it's economically efficient as well. So in its current form, this bill aligns with the Council's priorities and objectives, and we wholeheartedly support its passage. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Lisa? May I, before you leave,
yes, ma'am.
I just want to make sure, because I'm reading about that the Marine Board is actually going to compile the list, but they're going to consult with you and a number of other agencies to before that information is distributed. And is that going to be updated on a regular basis? Because you know, my years of working with the Department of Ag, those the species change over time, so I'm assuming there'll be some updating process as well.
Madam Chair, that is correct. It will be updated, and the Marine Board will take the lead in it, and there will also be some trainings, too, that go along with this program as well, so that people don't get hurt removing some invasive species.
Great. Can the Marine Board come up?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Yeah, we don't want people getting into taking out native blackberries.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board.
I just have one question. I'm concerned because it says rivers and streams. Would this bill not include lakes? Could we not do work on banks of lakes?
And Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I think it would include any water body that we currently work adopt a river program with. So it really wouldn't change the water bodies that are adopted, just what they would be allowed to remove as part of their program.
So if someone
follow up.
So if someone wanted to come in and adopt Mercer Lake in Florence, they could adopt the lake and go out and you would tell them how to take out invasive species.
And Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, what we do is we work with, at this point, Solve is who we contract with for this program. They actually run what is adopted, who's adopted it, and what they're removing. Under this bill, we would provide for them the species that would be removed from a certain area that they would look at removing.
So I guess my question was, should have been to Solve whether they would do lakes.
Yes, they're nodding their head, I think.
They will?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay.
There you go. I think you've got a volunteer right here to take on some
we'll
projects. Okay, any questions for the department? Looks like Senator Thompson is not going to let you off.
I have a question.
Sure.
Thank you. Scott, a couple of years ago they added a $10 charge for invasive species on licenses.
$5.
$5.
Yes, yeah, that okay. They was us, the legislature.
Right.
That was before us, Chuck.
Yeah. So they.
Free.
Yes.
Yeah. How much does that bring in a year? What are you doing with that money now? And is this going to use up all those funds, or are you supplementing this program? How does that work?
And Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson. This is a little bit different from the Aquatic Invasive Species Program. This is actually funded out of the Boating and Waterways Fund and has been an ongoing program we've had for many years, targeted at litter, not at aquatic invasive species.
Okay.
So the AIS piece has been added. However, the funding will not come out of the AIS program as it's currently written. It'll continue to come out of the Boating and Waterways Fund for this program. As to the AIS program, it brought in about $1 million this last biennium, and that money was used for eradication of invasive species, a lot of education, and then inspection of boats to look for invasive species being transported around the state.
Just to follow up, so that money, you're doing your own invasive species eradication with that money. This doesn't really affect that. It won't cut into that.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, we are not doing eradication with that money at this point. That money is being used for education, inspection, wash stations, things like that that'll help bring those out. You know, the beauty of this is you're using volunteers that are putting in huge amounts of hours that we could not fund under that program, no matter how much you charge people. We could not remove that amount of either litter or vegetation with paid staff.
Yes, and just to follow up, just to be clear, as you see on page 1, lines 7 and 8, this is an existing program. It's an existing statute. What we're doing is expanding it. Right now, it is limited to just removing litter. Mm-hmm. So we're expanding it that we have this whole cadre of volunteers that are going out and cleaning up waterways, and what we're doing is expanding that authority to be able to remove invasives with direction from the Marine Board. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So it's just an expansion of existing program, and we have many wonderful volunteers that are interested in doing this, but we want to make sure they're removing the right species and doing it in the correct ways and that they're getting the guidance that they need to do it. And that program's contracted with Solve currently, and so this would just expand the duties that those volunteers are doing.
Correct.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay, anybody else like to testify on this? Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3157. I'll open up a work session on House Bill 3157.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3157 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves House Bill 3157 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. That the motion carries. And Senator Haas, would you be willing to carry this to the floor? Okay, so noted that Senator Haas is the carrier. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill, or House Bill 3157. I'm still in Senate Bill mode. And we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2122. Beth?
Madam Chair, members, there is a dash 5 amendment in your packet for House Bill 2122. You heard this bill back in March on the 22nd. There's also a minimal expenditure statement, so basically no fiscal impact, no revenue impact on the dash 5. Dan Hilburn from Department of Ag and Lisa Debra-Kerr are here and can talk about the amendment if you'd like.
You guys want to come on up? We heard this, colleagues, about a month ago, if you recall, and we are up to the dash 5 amendments. Hopefully we got it right this time. Senator Olson, you helped work on this, so I appreciate that. And why don't you walk us through what this amendment does, Dan? Lisa, whoever wants to go first.
For the record, my name is Lisa Debra-Kerr, Oregon Invasive Species Council Coordinator. So this dash 5, and I promise we're not trying to set a record for amendments here, but we are at dash 5.
Oh, believe me, you're far, far away.
It does just two basic things. One, it changes this regulation from being focused on firewood from Oregon to include all of the Pacific Northwest. So it now says that any wood, any firewood, can be sold in the state of Oregon from the Pacific Northwest without any kind of regulation associated with it. Prior to that, in the dash fours, it said if it was outside of Oregon, so Washington or Idaho, wood would have had to have been certified or treated and be labeled and that sort of thing. But because of the species that we're worried about, emerald ash borer, Asian longhorn beetle, those are not found in the Pacific Northwest yet. We're not concerned about Washington wood and Idaho wood. And many of our big firewood sellers in the state of Oregon, our largest businesses, get their wood from southern Washington, and we didn't want to affect any Oregon businesses with this bill. So that was a substantial improvement. And the second thing is that we had a lot of small mom-and-pop wood sellers that would cut a couple of cords of wood a year and sell it outside of a state park, on the way to a state park, or on the way to a campground, and we didn't want to have them keep a lot of records for just wood that they harvest locally. They're not going to Minnesota to get this wood and selling two cords a year outside of Fort Stevens State Park. So we removed all of that language that requires these small mom-and-pop operations to have any kind of labeling standards. And Dan, anything else that I overlooked?
For the record, Dan Hilburn, Department of Agriculture. That was a great summary. Lisa, I would say on my way here, I stopped at Safeway to see what the label on the wood was, and it's coming from Grants Pass. So that's a good example of a company that is harvesting locally, selling locally. They would not be impacted by this regulation, but somebody bringing wood from out of state, outside the Pacific Northwest, would have to treat the wood and label it. And in Salem, Oregon, we have found wood from outside the Northwest in the past, including Canada. So it's that wood that we're targeting with this regulation. The department is very happy with the dash fives.
Okay. Any questions for the department or for Lisa? I did have one, and that was about notification and getting the word out to folks about this. How do you intend to do that?
We received a $500,000 grant from USDA APHIS in 2010 to conduct an outreach campaign in Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. We have funds remaining from that to continue that campaign in 2011. That will be a key focus to our message, and we've applied for FY11 Farm Bill funding that will take us into 2012 to continue the outreach.
Excellent. Okay, I really appreciate the work that you've done. I want to thank Senator Olson and Representative McLean, who have spent many hours, it seems like, to get us where we are right now. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Chair Dingfeller. I just have kind of a silly question. There, we get Do we get wood from out of the country? There's no treaty. Have you looked into all the treaty agreements and all that? Is there anything out there that has that question been asked?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Thompson, the answer is yes. Believe it or not, the United States imports firewood from outside the country and not just Canada. So Estonia, firewood coming from Estonia, that's a big problem. That's a national problem, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture is looking into that. But it's a problem, and I don't think it's economical except that you have ships that are deadheading, and if you can put anything in a ship, then you make a little money. So that's what's going on. We probably have ships passing each other with wood on the ocean. So there's a national problem besides what we're trying to fix here.
Senator Pozanski?
Yeah, just want to follow up on what Senator Thompson asked. And what you said, looking at this wood that was at, in this case, Safeway, is there an obligation now that the wood that is being sold retail, like at, let's say, a commercial location, actually be identified as the source of where the wood's from?
No, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Pozanski, there isn't any now.
All right. So part of the education component of this is going to be trying to reach out to, let's say, retail operations that sell firewood for people to take out to camping, et cetera, to make sure they understand they need to be able to ID the source of the wood?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, yes. We have already begun working with lobbyists for large chains. Fred Meyer, we've worked with them. Safeway, we've talked with them. And the three states are working together to talk to a lot of the chains, at least, to start getting the word out, even like the 7-Elevens, gas stations, those type of places. It's going to take us a while to get to everybody, but that is part of the outreach, is educating the people that are actually selling this stuff through the distribution chains.
Thanks.
Okay, great. Excellent questions, and glad we got that on the record. Any other questions? All right, thank you. Anybody else would like to, well, we're in work session. So any other questions before I take a motion? Okay?
We need to assembly amendment.
Yes, we do. You can wing it. I know you can.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2122-5 as amended on 329-11 be accepted.
Okay, is that the date of the amendment? Let's see.
So that's what I have.
Yep. Yeah, let me make sure. Okay, Senator Olson, very good without your cheat sheet. He moves the adoption of the Dash 5 amendments into House Bill 2122. They are dated 3/29/2011. Any objections to adopting the amendment? Okay, seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2122 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2122 as amended with the Dash 5s, dated 3/29/2011, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? May the clerk call the roll, please.
Senator Howe?
Aye.
Senator Pozanski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder?
Aye. With that, the motion carries. And Senator Olson, would you like to carry this since you did quite a bit of work?
Sure.
Okay. That Senator Olson is the carrier, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2122. And Beth, anything else for the day?
No.
Okay. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Another beautiful day.